Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Leland Stillman. Leland is an American integrative medical doctor who specializes in environmental medicine. Leland realized very early on in his career that conventional medical practices focus on symptom management rather than optimal health. The word doctor is derived from the Latin word docere, meaning to teach. Something Leland saw was absent in the centralized system. Spurred on by his desire to follow Hippocrates' notion that the greatest medicine of all is to teach people how not to need it, he started his own practice. He works with patients all over the world and in Naples, Florida, where he currently resides, on the fundamental aspects of health. He also works closely with Clark Engelbert of Nutritional Analytics, where they teach HTMA interpretation through stillmanwellness.com. I've known Leland for several years now, and he was kind enough to take me under his wing a few years ago and teach me a lot of what he's learned. I have seen him prioritize his patients to a degree I have not seen in any other doctor. He truly cares for his patients, and more importantly, his aim is to get them to a point where they are vital enough and can take care of themselves, a goal unfortunately not mirrored in many other practitioners. I have a deep respect and gratitude for him as he has been instrumental in my personal health journey. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Leland, I've been trying to pin you down for a time for years now. So we finally got it to happen. I'm very glad to have you on because I was just telling you I don't often have MDs on the podcast. So it's actually good to get a bit of a different perspective, a bit of a different light on how this all works and what it's like when the rubber meets the road for patients to work with practitioners who know what they're doing. So what were some pertinent moments in your medical training that sort of led you down this path of, you know, getting out of the conventional way of doing things?
So it was really that I grew up in a family where we used a lot of integrative and alternative medicine. And so I just grew up with it. And then my father was very conventional. My mother was very unconventional. My father was very conventional. So I grew up in both worlds. And my first mentor, who was a naturopath, told me to go to medical school to learn everything that I possibly could so that I could have the strongest licensure and the most scope of practice, the widest scope of practice. And that's the short version. I feel like I give that on every podcast, but it's funny that you phrased it the way that you did, because you said, what were some moments in your medical training that made this obvious? The power of conventional medicine is really on display in the ER and the ICU, in places where we're doing really unusual things with things like IV fluids and mechanical ventilators, which got a really bad rap during COVID for various reasons. And I'm not an expert in that. I wasn't in any place where, you know, bad things were happening. I heard lots of horror stories from practitioners. I don't know if I care to get into that. But in the end of the day, I've seen so many people resuscitated in the hospital, in the ER, in the ICU, that sometimes I actually miss it a little bit, because that is really acutely saving lives. It's very fun. But what's funny about it is that, looking back on it, I was very skeptical of my medical training. And I remember looking at all the drugs they taught me to use and thinking, I don't think any of these really work. So what I'm going to do when I get out of training is I'm actually going to just pare back everything and use as little as possible. And that's exactly what I did. And so I would discontinue medications. And one of the things that came through as the most important thing that got people better was IV fluids, which fits completely with the paradigm that I then eventually ran into, you know, that you've had Dr. Cruz on now to talk about, and that, you know, I obviously know well, which is the quantum perspective. Light, water, magnetism, all these things. That was a moment, was when I was, you know, looking at medicine and saying, well, this, you know, a lot of this drug therapy is just total hogwash. But what we do in the ER, the ICU, urgent care, can be really powerful. And then I had experiences in the integrative and functional medicine world after training. I thought, coming out of training, that I was going to find someone who I wanted to work for. I had a very disillusioning falling out with my first mentor, and really just came to the conclusion that he was just a total nut job. And I say that with, I don't know, all due respect, But you know, some people are just delusional about what they can do, about what's real, what's not real. I think growing up, that's hard for people to really wrap their minds around. In fact, I think a lot of people never wrap their minds around that. The things they grow up with as normal are normal for them until the day they die, no matter how obviously confused they are, which is really important in medicine, because if someone's got a worldview or a belief about themselves or the world that you can't shift and can't change, sometimes they'll never recover because it's such a pathological way of viewing people and themselves. And we had a falling out. I thought I would come out of training and find some great job because I figured I'm motivated, I'm smart, I care, I'm very well trained. All someone has to do is show me the ropes and then I'll work for them for the rest of my life and be happy to just have a good job that I feel really fits with my worldview and my values. Came out of training, long story short, hopped from job to job, and realized that in the integrative and functional medicine world, we have problems that are just as big as the conventional medical world, with people not truly practicing what integrative and functional medicine preaches, you know, over-relying on supplements, not taking enough time with patients, not spending enough time on education, not spending enough time on coaching. I'm not saying obviously that's true across the board. It's just what I began to see was there wasn't anyone out there who I wanted to work for. And one of the people who I most enjoyed working for, as just an example, and I won't name names, I really enjoyed working for them, but they couldn't pay me enough for me to continue working for them. And I realized, wow, integrative and functional medicine have a huge problem with the whole way that the incentive structure is set up. And that's when I just bailed on working for somebody else and just started working for myself. And that's been an incredible journey. It's been very hard. I didn't think it would be this difficult. And what I've created now, I'm really happy with, because we provide great care, great outcomes, and we can meet people's needs and meet them where they are and help them understand how to get to where they want to go. And we take a very different tack than most functional and integrative medicine clinics, because most of those clinics and practices are, they're sort of on the churn and burn model, which is, yeah, there's no continuity. You can't get in for 3 to 6 months. When you do, it's very expensive for a very short period of time or even a long period of time. And I haven't found that that's the secret to great results. Contrary to that, I think the consistency and long-term commitments are the secrets to great results. And that's really what we do. And, you know, my experiences in functional medicine with short-term engagements is what shaped that. I saw that people would try, you know, sometimes somebody comes in and you work with them for 6 weeks, 2 months, even less sometimes, and you make all kinds of problems go away. You get incredible results, but you'd also get a very, I don't want to say high proportion, but you'd get a fair number of treatment failures. And it wasn't that I didn't know how to fix them or help them. It was that we didn't have the time to really get into the case. So I'm not even sure if that's where you were thinking I would go with that answer, but that's the answer to that question.
No, it's really interesting talking to someone who's worked with probably thousands of patients at this point to try and understand what are the best ways in which, you know, you can actually, as a practitioner, you can actually get people to help themselves. Because I think this is something that a lot of practitioners come across at some point is, you know, you want to think that you're like a mechanic working on a car where you can just, they just have to stay there and you fix them.
Right.
But unfortunately, that's not how it works. And I think a lot of practitioners come across this later in their career where they realize that the patient has to be the one doing the work. You are just the guide and the person with enough wisdom to help them make the right decisions. How is that working with people who sometimes aren't ready to take on the responsibility to, you know, put in the hours, put in the effort, make the changes that they need to make to get healthy?
So I've learned the hard way that the number one conversation that has to be made or had between a physician and their provider, whether that's a coach, physician, acupuncturist, whatever, is where are you? Where would you like to be? What are your goals? Be specific. What does that look like? Don't tell me you want to look good and feel good. To a 65-year-old grandmother of 10, looking good and feeling good might be compared to one of her friends, 30 pounds overweight, right? And, you know, you'll get 75-year-olds who want to be able to climb 14,000-foot peaks in Colorado next summer. And then you get 75-year-olds who are going to be happy if they can get out of bed and bear weight on their knee. So being specific about the goal is really important. I get crystal clear. Where do you want to go? And why do you even want to bother to get there? Because the funny thing about problems and complaints and medical issues is that people actually don't care about what their medical problems and complaints are. And that might strike people as very odd or totally absurd to hear. But that's the truth. Here's what they care about. They care about how these things impact their life. So they don't care that they have psoriasis. They care that it changes their appearance. They don't care that they have eczema. They care that it changes how other people perceive them. They don't care that they have arthritis. They care that it keeps them from playing pickleball. They don't care that they have brain fog. They care that it is decreasing their ability to take care of their family and relate to their family and enjoy their life. So you have to understand what is the pain that you really have. What about your diagnosis, no matter what the label is? I don't care if it's Epstein-Barr or chronic Lyme or, you know, brain fog or whatever. What is the pain behind that? What is it preventing you from doing, keeping you from, or what are you afraid that it's going to snowball into that you want to avoid? And then the conversation has to be, what kind of progress do you want? It's a very different ask for somebody with, say, knee pain to say, I just want to be able to get down on the floor and play with my grandchildren versus I'd like to climb Mount Kilimanjaro this winter, right? And once I've established where they are, where they want to go, then the conversation is about what have you already tried? Because this gives me an idea of what are they willing to do. You know, people who want to perform, who want to perform at a high level and look like they're young at 75 or anywhere north of 50, who are not prepared to put in the work, they need to have a conversation about expectations. You know, I'll often tell women who are trying to lose weight postmenopausally, I'll say, look, if you go to these native peoples, hunter-gatherer tribes, indigenous, whatever, however you want to describe them, people who don't live modern lifestyles, who have low levels of disease, chronic disease, that is, Alzheimer's, dementia, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, et cetera, right? You don't go to these tribes and say, wow, that woman over there who's 56 years old could win a figure competition in the United States. That doesn't happen. Women gain weight as they get older. The more kids they have, the more it happens. What that means is that postmenopausally, women are going to have to, if they want to maintain that youthful figure, they're going to have to do things like weight training. They're going to have to do things like bioidentical hormones. Rarely, very rarely, will you find a woman who really has the figure that she wants or that she had at 18 or 20 or 25 in her postmenopausally, who isn't eating a very, very careful diet and weight training. If she's not doing both of those things, and frankly, most of those women were doing those things before they hit menopause. This is equally relevant for men, right? And men fall into the habit of overworking, overstress, and they get used to being able to perform at a high level despite sometimes inadequate calories, poor food, processed food, no exercise, no sunlight, anything. At 20, 25, 30, 35 rolls around, and boom, all of a sudden, they're not able to perform at the same level they were. Whether we're talking about the boardroom, the bedroom, the soccer field, you guys call them soccer pitches down there, whatever. You get the idea, right? You guys call it a pitch field.
We do, yeah, pitch field. It's a little bit different because we've got the British heritage.
I know, here. I know. We have British heritage too.
Yeah, that's we true. You've sort of made it your own. We're a bit younger than you, though.
Yeah, right. So that's the conversation that has to be had. And then it's all about managing expectations. Hey, you expect to get this crazy, unrealistic goal without putting in the work? That's not realistic. And people who are not realistic, I won't offer to work with them. And it's not that I refuse. It's that they have to revise their expectations. And one of the expectations that people have to have in engaging with medical care of any variety is uncertainty, right? And a lot of people are uncomfortable with uncertainty. They just want the 20 pounds of weight loss in 12 weeks or your money back. Well, if you do that, you're incentivizing your coach to get you to lose weight no matter what. And they may help you win the battle for your vanity or some meaningless number on a scale. And you may end up sacrificing your vitality. We take on a lot of women who have overexercised themselves into a very bad place. And many of them need to not only cut back on their exercise, but they actually need to refeed, and they'll get frustrated because they actually gain weight. And they say, Dr. Stillman, I feel so much better. I have so much more energy. My brain fog is gone. I'm able to engage with my family and my friends the way I want to, but I've got 4 or 5 extra pounds. And I say, look, double down on the weight training, double down on your habits. Don't try to calorie restrict, usually, right? That's not to say they might not be eating too many calories, but usually that's not the case. And it happens, it comes out. We work through it. But people don't understand that a lot of success is about being comfortable with uncertainty and also being comfortable with this concept that I don't hear people talking about very much, which is falling in love with the process of being well. If you focus on the results and the end goal, you're often going to fail because you're going to throw in the towel before you get to the end goal. If you focus on the process and you fall in love with the process, and falling in love with the process is the key to really great results, because if you fall in love with the process, all of a sudden the process isn't work, it's fun. And so you've got to love walking outside 3 times a day, like we tell everyone. You've got to learn to love your new healthy diet. We'll help you figure out how to prep your food, how to make it efficient, how to get these things rolling, And that's part of what the group coaching is so helpful for, helping people see, oh, this is how this person does it. This is how I can do it. They did that. I can do that. Right. So once we've had that conversation and we know that they understand what the expectations are, that's when you can start to have a conversation about really what exactly that looks like, because people also have different appetites for basically investment of time and money, right? And the more intensively they want to work with someone, right, the more expensive it has to be. And some people want to take a more gradual, slow, measured approach. Some people just want someone they can check in with once a year. And some people say, look, I've been feeling terrible for a long time. I'm ready to get better yesterday. And how fast can we get me to well? And then it's more about, for those people, it's more about, are you really willing to give up what's making you sick in the first place? You mentioned people having to work with the physician in order to heal. It's funny that you mentioned that, because Hippocrates said, and I think I've quoted this to you before, the patient must combat the disease along with the physician. And many patients don't understand that that's part of the deal. That's part of why the world is so sick right now with so many chronic diseases.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing to think about, because the patient is so intimately involved with their own recovery, they can't really rely on you. And I think a lot of people come into that relationship just wanting someone to fix them. And one thing that you and I sort of discovered at the same time was, this idea that sometimes they're not in the right psychological space to actually have a healing process. And this is something that comes along with trauma and just generally having poor interpersonal relationships. So how have you seen this play out with your patients? Are there some patients that, basically all that's wrong is that their psychological state is in the wrong place?
Definitely. But psychological state is a really loaded term, right? Because, if I give someone the right cocktail of pharmaceutical drugs, I could take them to the darkest psychological place they've ever been. And that's where people tend to fall into the trap of scientific materialism and, biomedical reductionism of, oh, well, I am just the result of the molecules and neurotransmitters and hormones that are running around bathing my neurons, in my intrasynaptic fluid or whatever. And the truth is that there is, and this came home to me when I started to see labs for people with hormones and neurotransmitters. You'll have people with the same hormones and neurotransmitters, and they feel and describe their lives and themselves in completely different ways. You'll have women who have suicidal depression when their estrogen levels are low and they respond to estrogen and their suicidal depression goes away. And then you'll have women who have, terrible depression of normal estrogen levels. And then you'll have women who have totally basement levels of estrogen who have not a bit of depression at all. So there's so much more to us than just the molecules and the biochemistry. But the biochemistry is the terrain out of which or and within which all of that emerges, if you think about it that way. The word emerge is a very interesting word to me. Emergent, there's a phrase called emergent properties. Emergent properties are properties that emerge from things. So like, you know, I look at health as an emergent property. It emerges from nature, just like I think a tree emerges from the ground. The ground is not one thing. It isn't just carbon or oxygen or nitrogen or complexes of carbon and oxygen and nitrogen. It is a complex mix of all these different elements of the earth. And it's a complex mix of those mixes. There's amino acids and carbohydrates and fatty acids, albeit in trace quantities. There's elements. Those elements may be bound to things like protoporphyrin rings, and there's bacteria and there's fungi and there's all these things, right, in the ground. And there's no one thing that makes the tree grow or makes it healthy, right? And the same thing's true of the atmosphere that the tree is growing into. And arguably the tree is just as much emerging, if you want to think about it this way, out of the atmosphere as it is out of the ground. Because if you grow, say, a tree in a box, a closed system, and you put 200 pounds of dirt into the box and you let the tree grow, what you may find over time is that the tree adds pounds and pounds and pounds and pounds of weight to that box. That's not coming out of the soil. Soil's mass is fixed. What's happening is the plant is fixing, right? It's fixing CO2, right? And as carbohydrates. So what does all that mean? Health emerges from the right environment. And if you have a toxic psychological state, well, I mean, I don't even know if I can say a toxic psychological state, but if part of your terrain is toxic relationships, they will create medical problems, you know, with enough time.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the biology of belief, you know, Bruce Lipton's work, you know, just how the way that we think is such an integral part of our health, because it's like the physical and the psychological are two sides of the exact same coin, and you can't neglect either of them. And it's interesting you bring up this dichotomy that where the biochemistry emerges out of something deeper. This is something that I've been thinking about quite a lot, which is that the biochemical level is way too zoomed in to really understand what life is. It's like trying to understand what a house looks like just by examining what the bricks are made of. You'll never know what the house looks like just by looking at the bricks. You can't understand the whole system at such a narrow level. And I think this is where the sort of the quantum biology perspective becomes so valuable, because you understand that the biochemical level is actually nested within that. And you will never understand what the biochemistry is telling you unless you understand everything that it is nested within. And this is, you know, it all comes back to the way that we think. And one thing that I got quite interested in, because I think everyone experiences this at one point or another, is actually enjoying their diagnosis or being embroiled with their diagnosis so much that they don't want to let it go because they make it a part of themselves. Have you worked with patients where that is absolutely the case?
Absolutely. I had a really fun conversation with a guy named Max Major, who's a hypnotist. We both went to he was a presenter he did a show at this retreat I go to in Texas that happens every once in a while called Runga. And he does this great hypnotism show. It's a fantastic show. And we talked about, because I watched what he did and I said, that's wild. And you clearly could teach me how to help my patients, because, you know, the whole trick, if you want to call it that, of really great integrative medicine is fundamentally behavior change, right? Even if it's just a behavioral change of taking a herbal detox tea every day, that's still a behavioral change. And we talked about it, and we went back and forth about how the brain works and how people think and how they behave. And he said, listen, tell me what I should read. I really want to read whatever you tell me I should read. So I went out and I read this book on stage hypnosis. It's called Deeper and Deeper, I think is the title of the book. And I started to learn about this concept of hypnotic language and the power of words. And it's become very apparent to me that the way we think and the things we say in particular have incredible power in a way that most people are not aware and won't believe, even if you tell them. But hypnotists know this because they've been doing it for generations now. They'll get people into a state where the subconscious accepts the command, you know, I am well, I am healthy, I am losing weight, I'm in the process of losing weight, whatever, right? People who are in the success world, the self-improvement world, they know this. They talk about affirmations, among other things. And I said to him, I said, yeah, you know, we've noticed this. The people who say my Lyme disease, my this, my that, and they talk about their label as a possessive. He said, yes, that's called hypnotic language. You're possessing the diagnosis. I'll point this out to people when I hear them do it on group coaching calls, but most of them don't do that because they'll notice, they may not notice this, but I'm very careful not to label people with diagnoses. I don't particularly care what label you've received from another doctor or is in the ICD-10 manual. That to me is rather immaterial. What matters to me is what are we going to do about it that's going to restore the properties of your being to a state where your health is going to naturally emerge from your being. And that's where language becomes so powerful and thoughts become powerful. And a lot of people who seek out functional medicine care, like you said, are looking for the doctor with the magic pill and the magic protocol to get them better. Even when they say that that's not them and they know it's about more than just a protocol or a pill. And then it's, okay, how do we give you and help you gain the insight yourself that the way you're thinking, speaking, and treating yourself is part of your own problem? That is trickier because you have to really get deep into rapport with them, and they have to be very comfortable sharing their most closely guarded thoughts and feelings with you. And then you have to be able to, out of them, identify where the problem is, and then give them a concrete action plan to go out and help themselves. I asked I'm experimenting with EMDR myself right now because I'm fascinated by all this. And I asked my EMDR practitioner this morning, I said, because she was asking about feelings I was having, and I was talking about feelings. My feelings are always in my heart. And I said to her, I said, do people ever tell you something other than the heart? She said, oh yeah. I said, like what? You know, is it their foot? Is it their shoulder? What is it? She said, yeah, you know, it's anything. A lot of head pain, a lot of headaches, a lot of abdominal pain. And she said, a lot of these people, I asked her, I said, look, do you see a lot of people going through EMDR resolving these acute or chronic complaints of pain in different body compartments or diseases of different body compartments? And she said, yes, of course I do. And it makes perfect sense when you understand how water is structured by energy, which is a combination of light, which is, of course, affected by and modulated by matter. And therefore, that if your thoughts and emotions are wrapped up in your water bonding networks in ways we still, I don't think, fully understand, and they're hooked into your nervous system, which operates through the coherence of water, that, of course, feelings are stored in the body. And of course, releasing those trapped emotions could lead to bodily healing. And what we do in the medical program at my medical practice is we really try to optimize that biochemical terrain with hormones and neurotransmitters and, you know, vitamins and minerals and their diet and their physical environment, you know, their light, water, magnetism, electromagnetic frequencies, sound, And oftentimes then the emotional and psychological issues come into focus. And once they're in focus and they see them for what they are, then they can really begin to work through them. But oftentimes that also requires us to talk to them a little bit more about, well, what exactly is it? You know, because we've seen so many various things. You know, I had a woman who said that once she, you know, went through her divorce, all of her chronic Lyme disease, candida symptoms that had been blamed on a wide range of different things, all those symptoms went away. Had a young lady tell me recently that her last headache was, you know, right before she broke up with her boyfriend. So you just never know. And that's why we have this conversation about goals, expectations, what it's going to take to get there. We have actually a fairly short list of points. I call them points of failure. There's a very short list of things that cause people to fail to get well. And I will go through it with them in some detail so that they understand exactly what could make them fail. And whether or not they accept it or not is on them. But we've done our due diligence in helping them understand where they are, where they want to be, and all the different things that could keep them from getting there.
Yeah, that reminds me of the start of You Are the Placebo by Joe Dispenza. He talks about getting in that bike accident. And he basically refused surgery because he had this idea that he was going to be able to heal everything himself. And over the following weeks, he actually does just by immensely focusing on what his body was trying to do. He basically knew that the body knew what to do, but he had to create the right psychological environment for that to actually happen. And he talks about just this process of letting go. And this is a little bit different, but I remember one time I had woke up with really bad back pain and it was really nasty. And I'm a bit of a creative person. I like playing music a lot and I have an artistic streak that sometimes doesn't come out. And I realized I hadn't played an instrument in a couple of months, which is very unusual for me. And I sat down and I was very uncomfortable. I played guitar for about 10 minutes and it was gone completely. And I thought, that's so interesting because, you know, creative people have to be creative. They have to have an outlet. And if they don't, it's kind of like just never crying. You know, you get that buildup of, you know, this emotion that doesn't come out. And then you see, you know, men who, you know, never cry their entire life and then have a heart attack at 45. And you start to think, well, the body needs to express itself in certain ways. And I think a lot of the time, the way that our modern society is set up actually doesn't really allow us to engage in those things with much ease. And I think this is, like you said, it's completely skipped over by the conventional system.
Well, I think, unfortunately, the world is, practically speaking, run by psychopaths and narcissists who don't have a respect for the complexity of the human organism and the importance of providing them the degrees of freedom necessary to meet their needs. You know, I work a lot with healthcare practitioners, providers, both as patients and on my staff. And you know, what is overwhelmingly the case in the healthcare industry, I find to be just the case in corporate America. People don't care about the individual. They don't care about the complexity of the human organism. They're just concerned with this kind of, you know, gross materialism, right? And I respect the fact, you know, right, I run a small business. Actually, it's two small businesses technically. And one of them's spinning off a third. So I have a lot going on as far as, right, bottom line numbers. You know, I have employees, certain things have to get done at work. But I also, you know, think that the people who really, for lack of a better term, sort of run society, they either don't appreciate this about people or they don't understand it. You know, they're working people without breaks during the middle of the day, no sunlight, you know, you can't say anything that might even remotely offend somebody else. people feel like they're walking on eggshells at work. They feel like they can't be honest about their feelings. They feel like they have to tiptoe around everything. They feel like they're not seen, they're not heard, they're not validated, right? And you know, the people who tend to wind up in positions of power seem almost by virtue of wanting that distinction to be the sort of people who don't understand these basic things that are frankly very commonsensical. And, you know, in a world where there's not so much control by authority, where people are more free, what ends up happening is people who are creative and disruptive and understand how people really are create new ventures and opportunities for people to work and to be taken care of if they're patients or coaching or clients or whatever. But sadly, I think that the market is being throttled by the people in charge. So the people don't have jobs that they're happy with. They don't have physicians, healthcare systems that they look forward to being cared for by. They're chronically unhappy with almost everything about modern life. And they're being sold this lie that it's because there's not enough rules and regulations and government subsidies. That's what my book is about, Dying to Be Free. I wrote about how absurd it is that we don't need more rules. We just need people to be free. Because if people are free to meet their needs and contract with one another, then they're going to find these things out. These are not things that you or I discovered. They're written in the pages of history. Doctors have been writing about these things since the days of Hippocrates. It's just that things have become so centralized, right? Medical school is so dogmatic. The curriculums are so cookie cutter. They're so myopic. They don't take into account any of this other stuff. In fact, the average medical school professor, when confronted with these things from the mind-body medicine world or integrated medicine, they just say, well, that's hooey. It's not true. It's not real. These people are total morons. I mean, truly, it beggars belief. The amount of literature behind what you and I have just talked about and summarized, it's staggering amounts of research and studies done not at, you know, podunk university, but I mean, you know, Harvard, Yale, Oxford, the places that people who are highly educated normally really most respect, regardless of whether or not those places have become corrupted or compromised by vested interests, which of course I hope people can see, particularly people who are listening to your podcast, probably appreciate how badly vested interests have compromised institutions within our modern world.
Something I've been thinking about a lot recently is this idea about whether you take axiomatically that nature doesn't make a mistake. And if you dismiss that and say, well, nature can make a mistake, that immediately opens the door to things like indiscriminate use of antibiotics, where you see nature as the enemy and you see things like vaccines coming out because you want to fight nature. You mm-hmm. don't, you, right. you know, it basically gives you a license. If you think nature makes a mistake, it gives you a license to try and have dominion over it. And I think this is what has happened, essentially, where medicine is predicated on the idea that our bodies are completely imperfect. They don't know what they're doing, and we need to use chemicals and molecules to basically try and fix what Mother Nature has got wrong. And I see this as a real dividing line between practitioners who, like yourself, who I assume you take for granted that nature doesn't make a mistake. And then, you know, the doctors that I work with in the centralized system are constantly trying to meddle with the systems of the body because they think everything's made a mistake. Everything's genetic and these genes are all wrong and so forth. And I think that's really dichotomy.
Yeah. Which is thinking that's been disproven decades ago now, right? And people who want to know more about that should read Tom Cowan's book on cancer and the new biology of water. Because if you do something like if you take a cancerous nucleus from a cancerous cell and transplant it into a healthy cell, it doesn't turn that cell into a cancer cell. The nucleus turns back into a healthy nucleus. And if you take a healthy nucleus out of a healthy cell and you put it into a cancer cell, the nucleus becomes a cancer nucleus. The whole central dogma of biology has been overthrown And these, I mean, tempted to be very insulting and derogatory, but these fatuous windbags in medical schools and PhD curricula all over the world don't even know that, because they don't even read the literature that they're publishing ad nauseum day after day after day. And it's staggering, the pride and the hubris coming out of the scientific establishment right now. It's really shocking. And I shouldn't say it's shocking, but it's very impressive. That's all I'll say on that. So, but the funny thing you said that we have to talk about is, you said when nature makes a mistake, because it's an interesting, you know, let's take that to an extreme, right? Let's say that nature never makes mistakes. Well, that would imply, I mean, what does that imply, right? Because is it natural for humans to cut the skins off of other mammals and wear them so that they can live in cold, dark places, right? Most people would say, sure, that's perfectly natural. We can do that. Okay, fine. So now we're assuming that it's natural for us to make implements that are sharp so that we can kill those animals and cut their hides off and whatever. And then it's natural for us to make fire. And now it's natural for us to engage in metallurgy. And now it's natural for us to create things. So then why isn't it natural for us to make antibiotics? And if it's natural for us to make antibiotics through a long, long, long series of, you know, innovations and discoveries from the scientific revolution onward, right? Then why is it unnatural for us to take antibiotics? And one of the most profound passages I've ever read in anything was Robert O. Becker's introduction to his book, The Body Electric, where he discusses what it was like to see the effects of penicillin being rolled out on the hospital wards in Manhattan, New York City, in the 1930s, 1920s. And it really was profound to read about this experience that he'd had, because I grew up in the era when antibiotics were just, I just entered the orders in the computer and they would arrive from the pharmacy. The nurse would hang them. I would come back a few hours later and the patient would be much, much better. And, you know, Becker's work, he writes about what it was like to watch people die from streptococcal pneumoniae, for example, and streptococcus pneumonia. And he saw, you would watch them die, and they would get sick, and then they would get delirious, and they would get febrile, and then they would get hypertensive and tachycardic, and then they would get hypotensive and tachycardic, and then they would pass. And then with a few grams of this white powder, all of a sudden, all these people who were dying were restored to not necessarily perfect health, but they were able to get up and walk out of the hospital days later after they'd been on death's door. And that really stuck with me, because, I mean, you and I have, you move in these same circles on the web and in the internet. There's people out there who are saying things like, you know, germs don't cause disease. And people infer from that, regardless of how true or not true that is, they infer from that that we should never use antibiotics. But that's not necessarily the inference there. The inference is there's a time and a place for everything. Nature doesn't make mistakes. Nature might just do things that you don't like. And when you start playing with fire, when you start playing around with nature's very complex, highly sophisticated systems that have been fine-tuned by generations of iteration, do you really think you're going to make an improvement on nature's design? And that's why I'm very circumspect whenever I do anything that runs very contrary to nature, because, and I usually have long conversations with people about this. Testosterone is a great example. So I use a fair amount of testosterone replacement therapy in my practice. But before I put a man on testosterone, I say, look, testosterone is what makes you a hard-charging, tough, strong, funny man. It's going to make you more of who you are. If you're funny, testosterone will make you, generally speaking, funnier. If you're smart, it's going to make you smarter. If you're fast, it's going to make you faster. If you're strong, it's going to make you stronger. And most men are like, great, I would love to have more testosterone, right? But the caveat is that if you take a guy who's kind of not so nice and give him testosterone, you may turn him into a jerk, right? And you may take a guy who's got a few bad habits and you may give him the energy to turn that into a disaster of a lifestyle, right? And this comes back over and over again with hormones and neurotransmitters. We're literally changing how people behave and how they feel and how they function, which they're delighted about. I mean, nothing makes me happier when someone says, Dr. Stillman, I'm 90% better. I have so much more energy and my mood's better and my relationships are better. And it's very common. I mean, usually my goal for everyone who works with me is 50 to 90% improvement within 3 to 6 months. And we have a pretty good track record of delivering on that, so long as they fully engage with the program of care. That being said, right, you sort of don't know what you don't know. And I wonder, we really are in an age, because bioidentical hormones are becoming so widespread, we've never lived in a society where men didn't naturally become little old men and ladies didn't become little old ladies. And we don't know what that's going to do. And I will always tell people who are going to start testosterone or women who are going to start bioidentical hormones, I say, look, these hormones are what keep you from becoming a little old person. So if you don't want to be a little old person, take these hormones. But if you, for some reason, have a problem with not becoming a little old person, don't take the hormones. And that's pretty cut and dry. I mean, I'm not saying they reverse or prevent aging. That's certainly not what they do. They retard the aging process. They keep a youthful appearance. They maintain a youthful appearance. But it's important for people to know that going in, I feel anyway. A lot of doctors don't bother with that. They're just like, oh, you're, you know, a depressed man with brain fog who isn't performing as well in the boardroom, in the bedroom, in the soccer pitch. Well, we'll give you testosterone and that'll make the problem go away. It's often, if not always, deeper than that. Diet, lifestyle, relationships, all these things, right? But this whole idea of second-guessing nature, whenever we're going to do that in the practice with a patient, I'm pretty clear with them about what we know and what we don't know, so that they're making educated decisions, so that they're not setting themselves up for failure later, because a lot of people do that. And it's very tempting to do, and it's very easy to do in the functional medicine world, because you know the trend and the general model is for people to come in every 3 to 6 months or a year for a checkup, or when their foot's on fire and they need you to put it out right this second. And that then usually puts them in a position where they're not getting the preventative care that they need, which is, I think, critical. And because arguably when you get the symptoms under control of an illness, that's when to me, the really fun work begins, which is the optimization, taking them from no longer struggling to get through the day to as healthy as possible and as far from illness as one can possibly be.
So I wanted to ask you about tips for a healthy home. So this is right. Everything from EMFs to the light bulbs yes. that you use, to the cleaning products right. that you use, air quality, all that kind of thing. What do you do and what do you recommend your patients do? Because oftentimes these small one percenters can actually add up and make quite a big difference.
100%. I agree. I just had a patient today tell me that because of a podcast I did a long time ago, they bought an air filter and it made a huge impact on their seasonal allergies. And they never thought that would happen. What I did was I created a system for this at my practice, because I'd seen many different people talk about these different components of the environment in various ways, but I'd never seen anyone present a system that you could take, because what we do is virtual. We don't see many people in person. We see some people in person, but we don't do home visits, which is really what would be necessary to truly evaluate how healthy someone's home environment is. And I created a series of questionnaires that actually, now that I recall, you helped me start to create at the practice, where I have now about probably 100 questions that go over everything from EMF to healthy, you know, home air quality to water quality. But it's also tied into how we're using these things, because, you know, it's one thing to ask, do you have warm light bulbs in your home that won't disrupt your circadian rhythms? And it's another thing to ask, do you get time outside during the day? One of these things is a habit that people don't think of as their home environment. And the other thing is a part of their home environment that they don't necessarily connect to their overall well-being. So I have a system at the practice where people get these forms as part of what we call our comprehensive wellness review. And we take them through all of them. It's essentially, if you might think of it, although this isn't a very exciting term, it's an audit. We're trying to find where are all the problems in your environment that could be contributing to your illness. And then how do we help you identify these things and what do we tell you to do about them? That's one thing that we cover in the consultations and so on and so forth. So, but overwhelmingly, what I find is important is getting a sense for, you know, first of all, how sick are they? People who are not that ill usually have a pretty healthy environment. The sicker the person, the more likely there is to be something very wrong with the environment. And usually it's not one thing. And then it's just a matter of, and I mean, the short list of things that I tend to gravitate towards as the most important choices with specific regard to the home is dim, warm lighting after night, preferably with low blue light light bulbs. Spring water is now my recommendation to people for a variety of reasons, most notably because it's not coming from water towers that are being irradiated with EMF from cell towers on top of them. I don't know if you have this problem in Australia, but our water towers, the towns and cities in the United States are increasingly putting cell tower arrays on them or cell phone arrays on them. And I worry about how that's affecting the water structure. And for those of you who think I deserve a tinfoil hat for even mentioning that, go look up Arthur Furstenberg's book, The Invisible Rainbow, and read it. This is not a joke, nor is it a drill. This is a real problem. So I'm trying to get people to drink spring water. You know, ideally, the spring water is coming from an aquifer that's so deep that it hasn't been touched by man-made chemicals from the Industrial Revolution. We're talking about water that's hundreds or thousands of years old. And even if it's new, it was filtered by layers and layers and layers, hundreds of feet of soil that can, you know, soak up the contaminants. And then beyond that, it's got minerals in it, which I think are very important for overall wellness and vitality, calcium, magnesium, things like that. So spring water, not using tap water for anything but bathing, and even then having showerhead filters, I think is wise. The indoor lighting is important. And then just living a low-tech life. People underestimate the power of simple things like having appliances plugged in. I recently visited a family member's home office. They were asking me for tips so they could avoid, you know, an illness that they're concerned about recurring. And lo and behold, their printer was emitting a lot of radio frequency radiation and they didn't even know it. Why? Because they didn't have any EMF meters. The EMF meters I recommend are at my blog. They're in a post called The EMF Detecting Gear You Really Need. And it's a simple kit, very easy to use, very easy to learn, very easy to get started. And people don't appreciate how these small things will really have a very profound impact. The other week, we had a gentleman come into a group coaching call and he said, I finally started to unplug my Wi-Fi at night and I noticed I'm sleeping better already. That's not uncommon. I've had some very weird things. I had a woman tell me that they turned off a lot of the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi in their house. And all of a sudden, they stopped having to set the clocks as often. So somehow the EMF in their house was changing the time on the clocks, the analog clocks, you know, the old school hands on a face type of clock. Really strange. What is that doing to people's biology, right? So little things, unplugging appliances they're not using, particularly Wi-Fi routers, particularly Bluetooth devices, you know, televisions and even the printer. I mean, printers are so weird. I had a printer once that had an airplane mode, but even when I put it in airplane mode, it still emitted EMF. Why does a printer even have an airplane mode? What scenario would I be in where I would take a printer on a plane with me, right? So then having your phone on airplane mode, you know, my phone's on airplane mode pretty much the whole day. It's probably only in transmit for 30 minutes to an hour. And the reason is simple. I love my privacy. I love my peace. I love my family time. I love being able to be fully present with people, whether it's patients on Zoom calls or patients in person or family or friends or podcasts like this. People have lost and forgotten the magic. Many people have never known the magic of being able to be fully present in the moment because they don't have this thing going off constantly, ding, 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 you know, reminders, notifications, text messages, updates, alarms. The toll that's taking on people's biology and their mental health is insane, and they don't even know. And just decreasing the amount of stimulation, decreasing the amount of EMF is so profound. And if people do just those simple things around the house, and then they do something simple as well, like people don't realize this, that overnight and during the day, your air pollutant levels really rise significantly. Indoor air is often 200 times or more polluted than outdoor air because it's not being regularly filtered. And the funny thing is that the people think that the outdoor air needs filtering because it's got pollen and dander and dust and all this stuff. In most of the United States, the air quality is so good. Australia is almost certainly the same way. The air quality is so good that it's much, much better than the outdoor air. And the other thing is it's being constantly purified by the sun, which produces hydroxide radical through ultraviolet light, which then destroys all of the pollutants that are out in the air. So opening the doors and the windows twice a day is a really important thing, believe it or not, for people to do in order to get those toxins out of their homes and then minimizing the amount of stuff going into their air is actually really powerful. You know, your body's not optimized to be constantly inhaling aromatherapy oils. I'm not saying you can't run your diffuser here and there and maybe all the time, but you know, people will go a little bit crazy with these, you know, Glade plugins and scent sticks and scent this and scent that. And you walk into some houses or places of business and you think someone with multiple chemical sensitivity would really suffer in this environment. And how do I know that my patient with chronic fatigue and brain fog and anxiety doesn't just have multiple chemical sensitivity that no one's diagnosed yet? And they're actually going to get much, much better when I just reduce their baseline level of air pollutants. Right? So that's the short list, but we have these long, they're not that long. We have these questionnaires that are designed to really help us dial in and not miss anything in a case. Because one thing I've learned is that when I can rattle all this stuff off the cuff, like I just did, but it's totally different when you're consulting with someone. There's details that, you know, no one's mind can remember or bring out with 100% reliability. It's a lot easier and more efficient for us to send someone a form, have them send their results back. And that's one of the ways we really help people. And also document, you know, this is what the problem was, so that it doesn't get lost in a conversation. Because many times people don't realize that the thing that's holding them back, they've already talked to their provider about, but it's not top of mind. They've forgotten about it. The provider forgot about it. And what's needed is actually to go back, review, and then hold them accountable for making the changes necessary in order to get the results that they want.
What's it been like working with Clark and using mineral balancing in your practice?
You just had him on, didn't you?
Yeah, we spoke a couple of days ago.
Oh, great. So you haven't released your episode with him then?
Not yet. But I mean, by the time people hear this, it will be out.
Well, you're one of very few people who's been, you know, we've been in contact since, I mean, I started my own practice, or at least very early on in my practice.
Yep.
And I went through the functional medicine world with a lot of different mentors and finally arrived at some protocols that I thought were the best of the best. And, you know, which was filtered through the lens of many different mentors and many different experiences, books, researching, conferences, et cetera. And then I, you know, started to work with Clark. And when I say work with, I said that I didn't know how to interpret my own hair tissue mineral analysis. So I started to talk to him and book time with him. And it became apparent to me that there was a lot for me to learn from him that I could incorporate into what I already knew. And there weren't necessarily huge departures from what I'd already learned. But what I did notice when I started to try the protocols he recommended was that I started to get better results in myself and in my practice. And so that's why we doubled down then on the HTMA coaching and training program, which we've now been running for it'll be a year in July that we've been running the HTMA program. It's been wonderful. It's been an incredible experience. We have a tremendous amount of fun. I tend to talk more about the blood labs, blood markers, clinical medicine, functional medicine as a whole, diet and lifestyle coaching, because that's where I've spent, I think, arguably, I don't know if I want to say more time than Clark, but because Clark's actually been practicing for a good while. And a lot of what he does is that coaching and things like that. But we just have very different perspectives and backgrounds. So we have a great time coaching people together. He's much deeper, obviously, in the HTMA side of it. He's been interpreting these tests for years. and has seen, I think, thousands of HTMAs. I think I've seen hundreds, certainly maybe 1,000 now, but a lot. So it's been incredibly fun. It's a great program. We really teach people how to understand these tests, how to interpret them, how to handle clients if they are interested in becoming a practitioner. We have many people do it just because they want to work with us and have this testing available to them. And then we have many people who do the program because they'd like to start to incorporate it into their own practice, or if they're not already a practitioner, they actually want to become a practitioner and learn how to do it themselves. So that's what we do. It's such a fun course. I really encourage people to learn more about it. You can find out more about that at stillmanwellness.com. And we're going to be enrolling our next cohort. I don't know if this will be out by then, but in June, you know, it's going to be enrolling this month, actually. And it's going to be starting in June. And then the next cohort will enroll in August and then start in September.
It's so awesome to see you guys working together, because one of those rare occasions where I've been able to sort of put two people in contact with each other, and it's blossomed quite well. So I'm very, very happy about that.
It's funny you say that, because I actually knew about Clark from years prior to you and I meeting. And then we just kind of were in the same space and we never talked. And then we ended up chatting.
Interesting.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. Cause I didn't know he had been around for that long. So it was interesting to see that he has been walking the walk for quite a long time now. What are some reading recommendations that you think are useful for people, not just at the basic level, but maybe even a little bit beyond? I always like to know what people are reading. It's very helpful.
What a great question. Most of my reading now is actually about psychology, leadership, because I have a team now. So I have to lead the team to success, which is actually a very different skill set than seeing people one-on-one, let alone group coaching people, although there's a lot of similarities. So I'm not going to tell you too much about the books I'm reading now. Although now that you mention it, there's a book. You mentioned the example of Joe Dispenza with using the mind to heal the body. I actually got a similar book on my shelf. It's in that vein. It's Hal Elrod's The Miracle Equation. He's healed from cancer and he had a car accident and they told him he would never walk again. And he was walking again. So another example of somebody who's got that positive mindset, that knowledge and that belief that they can heal. So that's been a great read. I'm really enjoying that. Books for people and just in general in health and wellness. The Invisible Rainbow by Arthur Furstenberg, I already mentioned. It's a great book. The Body Electric by Robert O. Becker, great book. I read on my honeymoon, which was last month, Cancer and the New Biology of Water. I think that's the name of the book by Tom Cowan. You should have him on if you haven't already.
I've tried. He's not an easy cat to tie down.
Is he not? That's too bad. And then I read his book, Human Heart, Cosmic Heart, which is a great read. Very thought-provoking. And gosh, I have so many books that I'm reading right now. Oh, another really good one. This one is not about health and wellness. It's called Fruit from a Poisonous Tree by Mel Stamper. That one is about the United States government and how corrupt it is. But
probably no shortage of books on that topic, I would imagine.
This one takes the cake. This is the best one I've probably ever read. I don't say that lightly.
Interesting. And what have you been learning about, not just in books, but even in the quantum biology space? Is there anything that has been particularly interesting for you, even if you don't know how it might apply to, health and wellness, just interesting things in general?
What I've been reading is where I've been learning. And I think, you know, part of why I'm reading more and more about, in the end, everything that I'm reading these days is about people. It's about how do we relate to people? Because how do we relate to people is really the name of the game for success in life. You know, at the end of the day, if you know and learn how to do that, and I think that's the most complicated thing that we're called on to do, you can really move mountains. And if you don't know how to relate to people well, you don't know how to relate to yourself well, and you will not get the results that you want. That's it. That's all there is to it. And I don't think people talk about that because I don't think most people understand it. And most people talking in the health and wellness space are still very stuck, for the most part, in the reductionistic biomedical model of gross materialism or scientific materialism. And they don't have this respect for the fact that it really does come down to the communication and the attitude and the mindset and the mentality. And that's why people have such a tough time wrapping their minds around, pun intended, Joe Dispenza's work or Bruce Lipton's work, because the medical model is so heavily and aggressively indoctrinating them into these models of, well, it's just about, you know, if you get your EMF and your biochemistry right, let alone your sunlight and your water and all this other stuff, all of which has value. I think I've made that abundantly clear. Then everything's going to be all right. But that flies in the face of my experience, which is that even when you get all that right, people will struggle if they don't have healthy interpersonal relationships and a healthy relationship with themselves.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that those are words of wisdom that you can only get from doing what you've been doing for a long time. And before I started my podcast, I always found it quite interesting. I used to listen to a lot of podcasts and, you know, I'd listen to people who had PhDs, who'd been doing incredible research on, nutrients and molecules and toxins and all this kind of thing. And they do this, you know, 2-hour podcasts all about their area of interest. And then at the end, you know, the podcaster would say, you know, what are your 3 big tips? And it was always like, oh, great, personal relationships. You know, you have to have, you know, love in your life and stress. And it was almost never about what they were just talking about for 2 hours. It always came back to relationships and
that's very funny.
Yeah, and it happened enough that I took note of it. I was like, wow, these people have spent their whole life researching this thing. And then, you know, they're asked about their most important tip. And it's always about, you know, having close relationships, having people around you that love you and care about you. And I think that's
Yeah. It goes back to what I said earlier, which is that people don't really care about their diagnosis or their label or the biochemical process or the biophysical process behind it. What they care about is how it's impacting their relationships and their place in society and their place in the world and their purpose. Sometimes people will say to me, well, you know, what should I do about this or that or the other thing? And I like to quote George Mallory. George Mallory was a mountaineer from England, and he was the first person to summit Everest, and he died trying to summit K2, the larger mountain near Everest. And he was asked by a newspaper reporter once, why do you want to climb Mount Everest? And he said, because it is there. And I found with myself and then with people I work with that there's always things they want to do. And if you ask them why they want to do them, they sort of can't give you a square or straight answer because, you know, why do you want to play with your grandkids on the floor? I don't know. It's like a deep intrinsic desire coming from a place so primordial that I don't know how to give it a name.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So that's what people care about. And that's where you got to get with a clinician who understands that and cares about you and cares about the outcome, not the label, not the diagnosis, not how many degrees of range of motion you have in your knee, but whether or not you can get the outcome that you want. Because oftentimes once you clearly define the outcome, it's actually a lot easier than you thought it was going to be.
We've come full circle. I think we've absolutely wrapped that up perfectly.
Thanks.
I will make sure I leave links to everything that you're doing so that people can find you. And I just want to thank you for giving me some of your time.
It's great to see you. Thanks for having me on. Keep in touch.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed the conversation. I've left all of Leland's links in the episode notes if you want to follow his work or connect with him. I've also recently started a Substack where I share my ideas that go beyond the scope of these podcasts and get deeper into information that can be used to directly influence your health choices. If you're interested in that, please check it out. I've left links in the episode notes. I've also left links to all of my other social media platforms if you want to keep up with the podcast or just reach out in general. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take care.